Welcome to Green Connections Radio, where we help you live green, work green, and earn green. I'm Joan Michelson. We are talking innovation with top leaders and thinkers in energy and sustainability and those who are transforming our world. You benefit from my extensive network of C-level executives, entrepreneurs, artists, authors, government leaders, and journalists, and my many years in the media and Fortune 500 companies. Find us online on greenconnectionsradio.com, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, and wherever you like to listen to your favorite podcasts. And we are talking to you live today from our iHeartRadio studio in Rockville, Maryland. Thank you, iHeartRadio. So to say this new year is bringing a potentially transformative shift in the energy and sustainability space is a dramatic understatement. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, or NOAA, as it's commonly known, just declared last year the hottest year on record, the fourth or fifth one in a row, I think. At the same time, we've had massive growth in the clean energy sector, courtesy of rapid innovations in technology that are transforming the sector, and an incoming U.S. administration that campaigned against climate change and has nominated a host of climate change deniers, fossil fuel supporting leaders to his cabinet, who are all promising to cut federal investment in clean energy and to boost the oil, gas, and believe it or not, even the coal industries. I believe during the campaign, he said, we are bringing back jobs in coal. At the same time, companies across sectors have already invested heavily in transforming their operations to reduce their energy use, carbon footprint, and dependence on fossil fuels. So I would argue the train has left the station, but we'll see what my expert says. So what is an energy or power leader to do? Today, we have the perfect person to talk to about this. Peter Kelly Detweiler is the co-founder of Northbridge Energy Partners and a former senior VP of energy technology at Constellation. He has 20 years or more of experience in the energy sector. He's one of the most highly regarded Forbes energy bloggers and an engaging public speaker, and is writing a book on the energy and power sector in the 21st century. Full disclosure, Northbridge Energy Partners is also a client of Green Connections Media. So welcome to Green Connections Radio, Peter.
Thank you. Yeah. Nice to be here.
Good. Thanks for joining us. So here we are with all these forces converging. Give us an overview of how you see the energy and power markets today.
Well, that's in a nutshell. Okay, so what's happening is an old order is giving away to a new order, and that's being driven in large part by information technology, which is pervading all aspects of the electric energy and overall energy space. So what do I mean by the old order? Well, for the last 100 plus years or so, since Edison first kicked this thing off in the late 1800s, we've been generating electricity typically either through hydroelectricity or most importantly, through hydrocarbons. So we burn dead the fossilized parts of dead plants and animals, essentially, that have either been turned into coal, oil, or natural gas, and use that to heat water, which creates steam, which spins a turbine, which then kicks electrons out into the system. And we've been doing that for an awful long time. But in the last decade or so, solar and wind technologies in particular have really been coming on strong. At the same time, gas turbines have become more efficient. We've found a lot more natural gas through fracking, which is another improved technology. And now we're starting to see battery storage. So in the form of both batteries directly related to the grid and electric vehicles, which connect to the grid as well. So we're starting to see all these different technologies cluster around, particularly around the grid edge. And customers are now interacting with the grid in ways they never did before. So there's all kinds of different models emerging, and they are all supported by the fact that we now have computational capabilities that we did not enjoy a decade or two ago. So we're creating this network, I call it the global central nervous system, essentially, where we're putting sensors on everything. And then our data centers will be the nodes, if you will, that create that central nervous system that connects everything. So at the highest level, that's what's going on. And I'm sure you have a question. Otherwise, I could keep going on forever on this.
Yes, I have about seven going through my head. So talk a little bit about big data. I mean, one of the things you and I have talked a lot about is this central role of big data in what you call the new order of energy and power markets. So Hold that thread for me a little bit.
Let's talk about what it's starting to do and what it can do.
Exactly.
So first of all, a really great book that I recommend highly for people who want to understand the power of how computers are leveraging human intelligence and, in fact, may do more than that at some point is The Second Machine Age, which came out a few years ago. And it's just really interesting because it changed, you know, it's all about Moore's Law and how computational capabilities are increasing. For example, if you're trying to create better battery technologies, right now we use Edisonian testing where you basically look at the periodic table, take a whole bunch of elements and say, what if I combine these two or these two or these two? What kinds of compounds will I get? And what will I get in terms of ductility, conductivity of light, conductivity of electricity, brittleness, etc.? And you all had to do that in the real world, which took a lot of time. The lithium-ion battery, for example, took about 20 years to get to the point where we actually worked out the chemistries and brought it to the market. With this new way of doing this, you can actually take all these properties and chemical various elements and create chemical compounds virtually. That is, not in the real world, but in the computer world. And you can model them there and test them there and then boil the ocean down to a wave of a smaller number of theoretical compounds. Then take those compounds and build them in the real world and then test them in an Edisonian type of approach. You know, does this work? How does this transmit light, et cetera? And now you have the ability to learn much quicker. And energy, evolution, innovation is all about material science. It's about how do we make things that are stronger, faster, can store more electricity, can convert more photons of sunlight into electrons, etc. So the key to this all is taking materials and making them better. And computers can do that way better and way faster than humans can. So that's the first piece of it.
Are you saying that the data that because computers can move so much, can process information so much more quickly now, that it's faster to get to create the photons from materials?
It's faster to create new materials, like stronger carbon fiber or stronger materials in wind blades, better cells in solar modules, better battery chemistries in storage, in electric vehicles, et cetera. The actual physical compounds that make up the things that are surrounding us, we can make better ones faster because we can invent them more quickly because of high-performance computing.
Oh, okay, that's great. Okay, and they function better, they last longer, they provide more power, they're more durable, yeah?
Yeah, so we just learn faster, right? Okay. Humanity learns more quickly. Now you take those pieces and bring big data into the power grid itself, and you digitize machines. So you create the industrial Internet of Things and machine-to-machine communications. Now you have the ability, for example, if let's say you have intermittent wind and solar coming into the system, and you have natural gas, which backs it all up. Now if you instrument those natural gas turbines, you can make them capable of running more efficiently, smarter. The fleet can become optimized, et cetera, in ways that it never could before. So you can squeeze more value out of the physical turbines and allow them to integrate more renewables into the system because gas can ramp up and ramp down more quickly and accommodate the intermittency of the renewable power sources. So there's a lot of things that big data is letting happen at that level. And then finally...
Hang on. Part of what you're saying is that the it allows for this big data and the speed will allow for the mixing, if you will, of technologies to provide the photons as well.
Exactly. Because the other resources on the grid provide electrons, not photons.
Electrons, sorry. Right.
Yeah, because the other resources on the grid can respond more quickly and more intelligently to grid conditions. So one example is Texas. They have 18,000 megawatts of wind. They're going to get up to about 23,000 megawatts of wind, and wind is really intermittent at times. So they move from a hourly forecasting down to a much more granular forecasting in their system so they could see when the wind was coming online. They also put advanced forecasting systems out ahead of the wind turbines so they'd know what wind was coming to the turbines and know what kind of energy would then be produced so they could better forecast what the various wind farms were going to do and therefore what the rest of the system needed to do to accommodate either increases in power or decreases in power. So there's this overarching intelligence which is starting to pervade the whole supply-demand side of the system.
Okay, that's great. So in your, and that'll play into a question I want to ask you in a few minutes about what leaders can do with all of these. But I want to get into the trends piece. You did a really interesting blog at the end of the year in Forbes on the top electric energy stories of 2016 that I alluded to briefly. And solar, roughly speaking, top level, you talked about solar storage, solar plus storage, electric vehicles, wind, natural gas, and what you call the wild card, which is great fun, and we'll talk about that. So talk a little bit about what you saw as the big trend in solar, because we had a lot of investment in solar for the last 10, 20 years, especially with the Recovery Act and ARPA-E, et cetera, and a lot of private companies and private capital going in. So what was it about 2016 that made solar what you call astonishing, have astonishing growth?
Yeah, so what happened was, first of all, it was expected at the end of 2015 that the 30% investment, the federal investment tax credit was going to run out. Mm-hmm. So everybody was jamming solar into the pipeline in the United States for 2016. Then we got the Christmas present in the industry at the end of 2015 when Congress got tax credits for investment tax credits of 30% for solar and a production tax credit of 2.3 cents a kilowatt hour for wind in exchange for opening up oil to be exported outside of the United States. That was the quid pro quo. What that did was it accelerated the development of all the solar in the United States. So we actually will see a bit of a hangover in 2017. But what happened was everybody started putting projects into the ground. In the U.S. alone, we did last year more, or in one quarter of last year, more than we had done just a couple of years before that for a whole year. That's how fast this thing has been growing recently. And the costs are falling so that you see contracts in the U.S. in the 4 to 5 cents per kilowatt hour range. The levelized cost of a natural gas fired unit is 5.6 cents a kilowatt hour, according to the U.S. government. And in places like Chile and Abu Dhabi, we saw long-term fixed solar costs under 3 cents, and in some cases under 2.5 cents per kilowatt hour, which is just mind-boggling. Those prices are some of the lowest cost utility prices for any type of fuel we've ever seen in the history of humanity. That's how cheap solar is getting now.
Wow. And you point out that it's also roughly half the price of coal.
Yes, exactly. And coal is just going to have a real difficult slog ahead of it because they're not building new plants. Nobody's going to take the risk of building a plant with a 40-year lifespan when the technologies of all the competition are increasing so rapidly and the cost curves keep falling and are not even close to being exhausted yet. Meanwhile, coal is just not seeing a lot of improvements from a technology perspective. So it's kind of dead man walking, irrespective of what the current administration probably wants to do in terms of resuscitating it. And the other thing is natural gas is so cheap that the real enemy in that steel cage death match isn't solar and wind. It's actually natural gas because fracking makes gas so cheap that coal can't compete.
Mm-hmm. We'll get to the coal issue in a minute. One of the things you talked about briefly that I just want to give a tip on is community solar, and I know you have it. So where, how would someone who's listening who wanted to tap into community solar get it? And if you can describe it briefly too first so people know what we're talking about, but and where people might be able to find it, how they would, you know, what would they search for on Google to try to find it?
Sure. So about 25% of American households actually have access to solar power on the roof. And the rest don't because they live in apartments or the roof's facing the wrong direction. It's more east-west rather than north and south, or they have trees in the way. In my case, we built a new house 6 years ago, and I put solar hot water on the real estate I could use, and the rest was shaded by trees. So a couple of years ago, I was actually writing a Forbes article researching this, and I found a company that did community solar, which means they essentially put, instead of 20 panels on my roof, they might put 3, 4, 5, 10,000 panels in a field someplace. And essentially, then everybody has fractional ownership. So I, for example, own the output of 5 panels 35 miles from my house. Mm-hmm. And they offset my electric bill as if the panels were on my roof. It's called virtual net metering instead of net metering.
Oh, that's cool.
So if you're looking, go ahead. So if you're trying to look online, basically you'd put your state, if you live in Massachusetts, Minnesota, New York, California, those places have community solar, Colorado right now. So you'd Google either community solar or shared solar or solar gardens. And then you'd see a list of who the providers are, and then you reach out to them and see what they're offering. And you either, in some cases, you can buy the output of the panels. In other cases, you get a credit for 15% off of your electricity bill. Or you can buy a power purchase. It's very similar to the way solar is on your roof in terms of the financial arrangements you can enter into.
Okay, cool. That's great. Thank you very much. Another one of the trends you mentioned that I also feel strongly about, of course, is storage. To me, storage is the hub in the wheel because it ties everything else together. I mean, you talked earlier about the intermittency of wind, for example, and obviously there's also some intermittency with solar as well. So talk about where you see storage going. I mean, you're funny. You said it's everybody's favorite topic in 2016.
So the first thing is to distinguish between short-term storage and long-term storage. Short-term storage, let's take an example of solar, because it's a perfect example to think about storage. Okay, so let's say you want a solid stream of electrons, dependable, predictable stream of electrons coming out of a system. Okay, so a cloud comes over. Oops, you just lost your predictable stream of electrons because the cloud went over. Now you're not, you know, your solar panel is not producing the way it was before. But if you had storage integrated with it, you activated the storage and released electrons from that instead of from the panel at that particular moment in time, you'd still have that reliable, steady stream. Now, let's think about solar long-term. Sun comes up in the morning, sun goes down at night, or there's a rainy day and the panels aren't producing what they're capable of producing. What do you do when you need electricity in those hours of the day? That's long-term storage. So as we need power, we need to think about what are the best storage technologies that give us not just the quick stuff that we need every day, but the longer term hours mm-hmm. that also help that we can integrate more renewables into the grid. Does that make sense?
It does. So I saw that Bloomberg New Energy Finance is expecting that electric vehicles will be 35% of the market by 2025. Do you think that's realistic?
So the challenge is this. EVs are a better technology than an internal combustion engine. They accelerate faster. There are fewer moving parts. The maintenance doesn't cost much at all. And when they talk about price parity, they're talking about total cost of ownership. And I believe they're right, because when you look at how quickly battery prices are falling, the announcements that LG Chem and Samsung are making, you know, Tesla now rolling its Gigafactory into production, and if there's any analog at all in the solar industry, which I think there is, you'll quickly see these large multinational companies making their supply chains really efficient and finding out ways to squeeze out all the waste and the cost. And then that will translate into lower costs for the vehicles. And you're going to have, you know, GM and Ford and mm-hmm. VW and all these companies are now committing to say, Ford says we're going to spend $4.5 billion on our electrification platform. When you see that kind of money coming into the space, it's almost inevitable you're going to see costs fall within a very short time frame. And then when costs fall and people recognize it's a better product, they will start buying much more aggressively than they do today. Today in the world, we only sold 500,000.
Right. And we also need the infrastructure, though, to go with it. I mean, we've got the Chevy Bolt coming out, which, you know, will be priced about the same as a small SUV, would be my guess, or a...
37,000,
right. So, but you also have to have the infrastructure. I mean, as you know, well, I worked at Chrysler in the electric car division, and the big issue there is chargeability. Now, our cars were actually lead acid batteries and could be charged anywhere. I mean, you could even charge them on a 110. I mean, a 220 was better. But you have to have the infrastructure to get over the range anxiety. And I know these new cars are coming out with, in some cases, 300-mile ranges or promising of 300-mile ranges, for example, things like that, which helps. Yeah. But, you know, the American psyche and probably the European one as well is I want to be able to just go where I want to go, even if I'm not going there. The practicality interferes with the image of, well, I just want to be free, you know.
I want to take the ski trip.
Right, you know, if I want to, I want to, you know, tell my significant other I'm going out for coffee and go drive across country, right? So,
I interviewed a guy with a leaf, and it took him, you know, normal 8-hour trip to Maryland took him more than 12, took him 13. Why? Because the charging stations were off the road, and he had to charge, you know, he had 100-mile range. He had to charge every, you know, couple hours. And it took him 45 minutes or half an hour to 45 minutes to charge. But what's changing there is, for example, Samsung came out with an announcement at Consumer Electronics saying they're building a battery technology where you're going to be able to get 300 miles of range in the time it takes you to go get a cup of coffee.
Wow.
So what everyone's aiming for now is the gas station experience for electric vehicles.
Yep.
And one of the things the Obama administration did was they created this partnership and billions of dollars to support it, to build out charging networks across all the major highways in the United States of America.
Two of the other trends you've kind of already talked about, wind and natural gas. So I want to get to your wild card, the Trump effect, because a lot of the innovation and a lot of the regulatory framework, he can't touch because it's going on in the private sector and it's going on at the state level. But you mentioned, for example, the Obama infrastructure bill to build out charging stations all over the country. And there are other initiatives, the funding of ARPA-E, for example, and the funding of clean energy projects across the board from the appropriated through Congress with the Republican-run Congress now. Those are at risk. So what do you think, you know, put on your crystal ball here, look in your crystal ball, you know, where do you think, looking at what the cabinet picks now have been saying in their hearings, looking at the report that just came out from the DOE and Secretary Moniz, for example, on the progress that's been made, the private capital that the investments from the government has already attracted. I mean, ARPA-E alone attracted about $1.6 billion in additional capital to its initiatives. Where do you think this is going to go, and how much damage can Trump do?
So, and what I didn't write about this, but I've been doing a lot of thinking about it since, because the U.S. government funds, you know, dozens of national, or over a dozen national labs. So where I think, you know, short term, you don't see that much of an impact because it's a global market, global costs come down, the states drive a lot of the, you know, the dynamics. Here's where the damage is, and here's where this actually hurts the U.S. economy. But it's kind of like you drop a rock down a well, and you're not going to hear the splash for maybe a decade. My concern is that Perry, under Trump, will cut the DOE's research and development around clean energy in particular. But if we see the Trump administration dramatically cutting back on the research agenda, on pure science, not the applied science, but the pure science, the stuff that you can't point to it and say, oh, I did this and this was the investment return I got 2 years later. No, I'm talking about the stuff 10 or 15 years later, the kind of stuff that Bell Labs and others, you know, did and the U.S. government has done for years with no immediate hope for return, but just because it makes society and the U.S. more competitive and smarter, more capable of dealing with problems with, you know, technological responses.
Which is also how we got the internet, by the way.
Exactly. Yep, exactly. It's how we got fracking, right? So, you know, if we cut some of those areas, that's where I think we hurt ourselves, we shoot ourselves in the foot, long-term economic development, jobs, that sort of thing. But much of it wouldn't even be seen in terms of damage realized for a long time after a Trump administration is already in the rearview mirror. And that's probably my biggest concern as we look forward into a climate-challenged world where we need every technological card we can play, and we have the possibility of essentially taking a few aces out of the deck we won't be able to play, but we won't see the damage for years to come. That's my biggest concern.
So how much of that is being offset by the private sector's investment and by the state-level investment?
Well, see, the private sector investment, that's much more a tactical investment. It's based on a visible return. And so that's fine short term, because that's about technologies you can see for the most part and projects you can invest in.
And that has a shorter ROI.
Yeah, and it's a visible ROI versus like the ARPA-E stuff where they take in a concept. They say, we need to focus on this area. Let's go find companies that are doing this. Now let's go and incentivize them with some money and lend them our imprimatur and see if we can take that baby out of the crib and teach it how to at least take its first few steps before it's adopted by the private sector. If all that stuff goes away, we really hamstring ourselves competitively in the global economy, because the global economy is driven by electrons and will continue to be so in the future.
Mm-hmm. And that also goes to the issues of storage and in particular storage and also data. I mean, I know they're doing a lot of investing in storage. So if you're, which I know you do, you advise a lot of leaders on how to put their energy portfolio together, how to, in effect, provide power for their operations going forward. What should a leader do? What are the first steps they should take, say, in the first quarter or first half of 2017 in light of this? Now, obviously, we don't know entirely what the legislation is going to be, but we know there's a Republican-led Congress, so he's not going to get a lot of pushback on things, right? I mean, we get verbal pushback, but not a lot of voting pushback. So what's a leader to do? Where are the opportunities too?
Right. So the first thing is I assume that leaders look to cut costs. Obviously, whatever business you're in, the main thing you do is your mission. And most missions aren't to cut their electricity bill. But when you cut your energy costs, whether it's electricity, natural gas, all those savings drop to the bottom line. So when I advise companies on the consuming side, I advise them, okay, look at the structure of your electricity bill. What drives your costs? And are you dealing with issues like volatility? And are you concerned about exposure to carbon? And then I advise them, you know, you should think about long-term power purchase agreements with renewables, because you can ink a deal for say, 20 years at a fixed price versus power markets, which are volatile and all over the map and could go up. You know, fracking technology is getting better, but at the same time, there are requests to export as much as 2/3 of current consumption of natural gas. So nobody knows yet what that's going to look like. But you could see an increase in natural gas, which would then drive electricity prices. So first thing I advise is hedge a certain percentage of your electricity bill with renewables, because you're hedging your carbon exposure and you're also mitigating your risk of volatility in power markets. And then I say, look at how your power bill is structured. How much do you pay for your electrons? How much do you pay for infrastructure with utility through demand charges? Know how to essentially dissect that bill and understand where your exposure is with the different cost components. And that's what we help a lot of customers do. And then where's your volatility? Like, some people use power in really weird ways and don't even know that they're incurring costs because of their operating sequences.
One more question, then I want to ask you a couple things about you. But the carbon tax, even companies are already, even oil and gas companies are already planning for a carbon tax. They're assuming it. And some of them have come out proactively in support of a carbon tax. I mean, among other things, it provides certainty, right?
So, because they want to know what the pricing environment is.
That's right, exactly. And we still have the Paris Accord, and there's only so much damage that he can do because, yes, it's the U.S., but 197 countries signed on to it, including China. What role does the potential for a carbon tax play in the scenario of opportunities and advice?
You know, I think companies think about it, the consuming companies, and I think that's one of the reasons you see the Amazons and the Googles, et cetera, you know, the big, what the French call energivores, like a carnivore, but consuming energy, looking at those long-term power purchase agreements because of that. What I found fascinating was I recently did this 12-hour workshop on power markets, and one of the people in my class was an energy planner. And he basically said, I don't care what happens in 4 years in the Trump administration. And my jaw dropped, which is it's a pretty big jaw if you see a picture of it. Anyway, I said to him, I'm sorry? And he said, look, we're looking at this, you know, we're looking at 25 to 40-year time horizons. 1 4-year administration, even 2 4-year administrations, that's a small bubble for us. When we look at things like long-term trends, we look at technology trends, we look at climate change, you know, whether or not you wake up in the morning, like, you know, I joke sometimes that I changed my party affinity this morning to Republican and woke up and I had a huge weight off my shoulders because now I know climate change isn't real. Well, just because I changed my affiliation doesn't change atmospheric physics, right? My ideology does not change that at all. And these power planners aren't stupid. They may be trying to get what they can out of a system and out of administration, but they know the reality of the world, and they're planning for that reality.
Yeah.
And so many of them understand that inevitably, as we get warmer and warmer years and the science becomes harder and harder, and we see more empirical evidence of the manifestations of climate change, that that pressure is going to mount, and therefore they need to start developing mitigation and accommodation strategies accordingly.
Well, that's why I think that there's only so much damage that he and the Republicans can do, and Pruitt, who is took 5 minutes to get to the point to actually mention the that the EPA was designed to protect the environment, even though it's called the Environmental Protection Agency. That was kind of astonishing. So I want to ask you something about you, because you've had a really interesting career. And if you could give advice to somebody who, based on your experience and what you know about the industry right now, who wants to either transition into this space or has been sort of doing something in it, but in a more minor way than taking on a role like one of the ones you had, where would you advise them to go? Where do you think the opportunities are for cool jobs in this space? Like if you were advising, you know, one of your kids, for example, to look for a job in this space, where would you tell them to look?
Well, the first thing I'd do is say, what do you do well? Because many professionals spend a lot of time thinking about what they don't do well. And instead of focusing on reinforcing their core competencies and that thing that makes them stand out. So the first thing I say is, what are the things that you do? Do you write really well? Are you a great communicator? Do you understand numbers? Do you understand economics? Whatever. You know, what is it that you love to do? And then, where in the industry are the growth opportunities? And how might your skill set and your passions apply? So I just had this conversation yesterday with somebody at lunch who graduated from grad school and is looking right now. And she's a really good communicator. And so I basically said, all right, next premise is look for the growth opportunities. Solar's still growing, but it's flattening out a little bit. Storage and big data are going to grow just head over heels, right? Because they're just in their early stages. The big data, in terms of putting sensors on thing, making intelligence out of raw data, that sort of thing, that's just starting to happen. Smart buildings, not many of them. Smart power plants, starting to happen. Integrated power grid, early days, right? So there's still a lot that can be done in that area. And in the storage space, these companies are all startups right now. They're still developing their business models, and they're, you know, looking for help there. Certainly, software programmers have plenty of opportunities to get involved in places like that. And when I talk to people about what to look for, I just encourage them to, A, go to a lot of conferences, read a lot. I read 2 to 3 hours a day online because I have to for my job. But even if I didn't and I would just – if I were looking for a job, I would spend at least an hour a day reading Green Tech Media, Bloomberg New Energy Finance, Solar Wake Up, a lot of these different environmental storage newsletters, et cetera, so that you at least have a passing familiarity with the concepts and the language.
And the language, yeah, the language is
critical. Yeah, the language is critical.
So in closing, I want to ask you one more thing, and I've never asked you this, actually, so this will be fun. Tell me about a moment in your career, maybe midway, when you had to make a critical choice that in retrospect was a turning point, how you made that decision and what you think of it now.
Okay. That's an easy one in some ways. And it was the middle of my career. I was heading up a customer service group. We got bought by a new company. One of the people who bought us, we had a good chemistry, and he didn't have a good chemistry with my boss. And my boss had hired me and trusted me and nurtured me and a few other people. So she had kind of created this circle of young professionals who really loved working with each other and for her. And one day he came into me and he said, in confidence, I'm going to show her the door and I would like you to consider the job. And so I could have been the head of the office. And I said to him, I don't even need to think about that. The answer is no. And he looked at me and he goes, really? And I said, no, this person taught me what I know in the industry. And I know she would see this as an utter betrayal. And it would be. And so, you know, I thought to myself, well, the opportunity will come again. And it didn't for maybe, I don't know, 8 years, a decade, something like that. The cool thing is that person whose job I could have taken, I see her now quite frequently. She knows the story more or less, but not really. We're still on really good terms. And I walked away from that one knowing that I did the right thing. And then new things did come up in the future. And frankly, I probably would have been really bad at that job because I was relatively young and probably not mature enough to handle the rigors and the challenges of it. Mm. And I was maybe too passionate at the time as well. And so that's one that I didn't lose much sleep over, and I actually sleep better every day I think about that one.
That's a good one. And it goes to a values-based decision where you went with your conscience, which I think is critical for people. I mean, you have to do what you feel good about. I think it would have been completely different if she had come to you and said, hey, I'm getting a promotion, and I'd like to recommend you for my job. That's a whole different scenario. But for him to come at you that way, that also goes to, it's a reflection on the person who put you in that position for the guy who said, you know, I want you to tell her, which is really awful, or really I want you to take the job.
Yeah. If he laid her off and then came to me later and said, hey, this is done, you know, and I want you to step in, maybe that's a different conversation, maybe not, but it's not like, oh, you're taking her job and you know it, you know?
Right. Did you?
There's integrity.
That's right, integrity. That's why I said conscience-based decision. Yeah. It's an integrity issue.
Yeah, I mean, you live with yourself for the rest of your life,
exactly.
Right? So hopefully, you know, someday when you're lying in the hospital gurney with a tube in your nose and you look back at the movie of your life, you don't mind looking at all the scenes.
Right, exactly. No, that's true. And I think that's really the core of it, because I find myself that way. And when I am at different decision points, I go quiet and I stop getting input, and I just, you know, I get a ton of input, and then I put the input aside and just let it sit. And the answer surfaces because it's the one that feels right and that I put through that prism of, you know, when all is said and done, what will I feel best about, and what opportunity am I okay with never having happen again? Versus what feeling do I want to make sure I you know, go through life with, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I don't believe in the land of regret and those kinds of things.
No, because the other thing from a self-serving perspective, this is a very small world that we live in terms of energy professionals. We know a lot of each other, and the jerks in the industry are known and regarded as such. And they have a much smaller ambit to run in than the people that, you know, I know people that I would work with them anytime, anywhere, doing anything, because they're fun to work with. A handshake is as good as a contract, mm-hmm. and they're smart and motivated.
Mm-hmm. And they follow through. And when they can't,
exactly.
they tell you they can't.
Yep.
Yeah. Life is too short to play with people that you can't stand. That's why we're in the business that we're in, Peter, because we care. And that's part of what I love in closing about the energy and sustainability space is we have people in this space who come at life and careers and business from a values-based place, from an integrity base. They want to make a difference, and they want to use who they are and what they know and what they can do to make a difference, as well as to have an interesting, hopefully profitable life. And it's profitable on multiple levels. So that's...
Oh, yeah, without question. You go to a conference around alternative energy or storage or whatever and talk to people, and there's a very large percentage that feel that for them, this is not just a job. It is a sacred mission.
Yeah. So thank you so much for joining us today on Green Connections Radio, Peter. Peter, you're terrific. Peter Kettley-Detweiler, principal of Northbridge Energy Partners, and we will link to your site from our site as well. So what did you hear Peter say? What tips can you use today, this week, this month? You're going to take his job tips on where you think the energy and sustainability space job opportunities are and how to go about finding them. Tweet it to us at John Michelson or post it on our Facebook page and like it while you're there, or ask to join our new private Facebook group. or email it to us at info@greenconnectionsradio.com. And you can also leave it with a review of our show on iTunes or iHeartRadio. So thank you for joining us. I'm Joan Michelson. See you next time.
Hi, my name is David Goldberg, president of Edge Studio, a voiceover company. We oversee professional narrators and voice actors for sales videos, training videos, telephone pre-recorded systems, commercials, web videos, and all applications requiring voiceover. And in fact, for over 20 years and in over 100 languages, we have been considered the most trusted and the friendliest leader in the voiceover industry. We're a green company with efforts towards sustainability at all of our studio locations. EdgeStudio.com. Sound people who are happy to help.